morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday morning. The president is going to Colorado today. He's arriving in Denver, Colorado this afternoon. He'll be meeting with local law enforcement officials and community leaders and will be delivering remarks on common sense measures to reduce gun violence later this afternoon at the Denver Police Academy. The New York Times noted in an article last week that the president is seeking to regain momentum on the gun issue as a filibuster threat is growing in the Senate, and as a two-week congressional recess is marked by a nationwide activist push by the National Rifle Association. To counter it, the president heading to this state, which was of course made famous by two of the most high-profile gun massacres in history, and it is now the first state in the historically pro-gun West to pass serious gun regulations. Other serious gun regulations in the state of Connecticut, where of course the horrors took place at Sandy Hook Elementary School. This hour of the program, we're going to be talking about this gun issue once again with a guest who has graced our microphones before. Adam Winkler is joining us, and we'll be welcoming your phone calls as well. Professor Winkler is a professor of constitutional law at UCLA, and he's author of Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. This gentleman knows the history of guns in this country. We'll be looking at Colorado's new laws, Connecticut's laws, and what's going on with federal legislation. Professor Winkler wrote an interesting piece about the assault weapons ban that may have derailed the federal government's push for gun safety. Will there be a chance that there will be anything passed? Here's our phone number. I suspect you might be calling this hour. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And please leave messages on our Facebook page because we like to read them. And that's the Kathleen Dunn Show. Professor Adam Winkler, hello again. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Let's start with the president's visit to Colorado. It seems as though in the last month or so, the momentum has been lost for whatever you want to call it, gun safety, gun control legislation, whatever. What happened in the last month, and what will the president be aiming to do today?
Well, it does seem like there's a little bit of steam that's been lost on the push for new gun control laws, although maybe not as much as some people realize. One, the assault weapons ban that seems to have been dropped by Senator Harry Reid really had never had much of a chance of being enacted in the first place. So the fact that that's not going to be enacted now may not be a sign of things have really slowed. And we have seen a lot of momentum at the state level. We've seen restrictive new gun laws adopted in New York and Colorado and in Connecticut. There's new laws being considered in California and elsewhere. So we are seeing some movement at the state level.
What will the president aim to do today in his visit there and in his remarks later today?
Well, the president seems to have finally realized that the key for him is getting a background check bill passed. And so he wants to really focus on background checks. I think that one of the things that he realizes is that if he goes to the places where these mass shootings have occurred, he's more likely to get wavering senators and wavering constituents to think that time is ripe for some gun control laws. It's those high-profile shootings that really do seem to motivate Americans these days to think about gun control more seriously.
Was it a bad strategy for Senator Feinstein to take on an assault weapons ban? Should they have gone with something else first?
Well, in my view, it was a bad strategy. As I mentioned earlier, there was virtually no chance of the law being passed. And despite the fact that these weapons have been so demonized, people don't really have a great understanding of these weapons. You can sell the exact same rifle after the assault weapons ban, as long as it doesn't have a pistol grip or a folding buttstock. Those aren't the features that really cause guns to be used in criminal ways. And indeed, assault weapons are very rarely used in gun crime. And I think in some ways, focusing on banning a particular weapon really did the most to anger gun rights supporters and to poison the well for gun control. You know, for years, the gun rights people have been saying that President Obama wants to ban guns, and people in the gun control community poo-pooed that and said that's ridiculous. But what's the first proposal they put on the table is a ban on the most popular rifle in America. It just was a bad strategy.
Tell me about this rifle. What do people use it for?
they use it for the same purposes they use other rifles. They use it for hunting. They use it for target shooting, recreational shooting. And sometimes, though not very often, they can use them for defense. You know, we think of it's basically a military-style assault rifle. It's just basically another rifle that has certain military-style characteristics, like a pistol grip. It looks like a military rifle. But with the exception of the high-capacity magazine, which is not an issue that's just related to assault weapons, a lot of handguns and pistols have high-capacity magazines too. But if you separate that issue out, the assault rifle is really no different from all sorts of other rifles that are not being banned under the law. And indeed, when we had the last assault weapons ban, manufacturers just made and sold by the millions the exact same rifles, just without the pistol grips.
What has the NRA done in the last month? They're very effective politically. What have they done in terms of a campaign to sway members of the Senate, to sway the American public? How successful have they been in whatever their campaign has been?
Well, we see the NRA resorting to its usual tactics, which is we can't support any of these gun control laws because they're going to lead to total gun confiscation. Mm-hmm. So we see that with regards to background checks, very difficult for the NRA to fight against background checks, which are designed to keep guns out of the hands of criminals and the mentally ill, people who everyone agrees, including the NRA membership, should not be able to get their hands on guns. So what they've done is said, well, if we have this universal background check, we're going to have a gun registry, and if there's a gun registry, that'll be used to confiscate all the weapons. In truth, federal law already has a specific and explicit prohibition on the creation of a federal gun registry, and nothing in the background check law will change that. So there's not really a threat of a registry, but by saying there is, they've really activated a lot of people into thinking, hey, if we support background checks, our Second Amendment rights are going to be nothing but a memory.
Well, I'm wondering historically, Professor Winkler, when has anybody ever mentioned confiscating all weapons? America's been around for, what, almost 240 years or so. That's a long time. Has this ever been a possibility that somebody was going to take away everybody's weapons?
Well, I don't know if it's ever really been a realistic possibility. It has been the agenda of some in the gun control community for years. It was especially popular in the 1970s when, as part of the Great Society programs, there was ideas that, hey, we could maybe get rid of all the handguns. And then when we get rid of all the handguns, maybe we can start targeting mostly all of the rifles and shotguns out there and really relegate firearms to law enforcement or occasionally being used for hunting and other kinds of recreational activities. Today, the gun control movement, maybe some people in the gun control movement still have those goals, but they seem to have become much more realistic that if you can't even pass a universal background check bill, you're not going to confiscate any weapons.
Yeah, no, I mean presidential administrations. It's always Obama's going to take away your guns or FDR is going to take away your guns or whoever's going to take away your guns. Why has that been associated with presidential administrations?
Well, the only realistic possibility for gun confiscation nationwide would be at the presidential level. I mean, at the national level. You know, states couldn't achieve that goal. And it's been a consistent refrain from the NRA for the last 30 or 40 years that any new gun control law is going to lead us down the slippery slope towards total disarmament. I think the most important thing for both sides in the gun debate to realize is that guns are permanent in America. There's over 300 million guns in America today. They're not going anywhere. We've tried to bar easy-to-conceal things that people love, like alcohol and prohibition. That didn't work. And we tried to do the same thing with the war on drugs, and it didn't work. I think if we tried to completely ban guns, it would be similarly as ineffective.
Yeah. When you look at the polls, you're well aware of these. It's well over 90% of the American public believes that universal background checks make a lot of common sense, don't they? How do politicians respond to that? That's an overwhelming number of Americans.
It certainly is, and what's really going to be interesting to see is if there's no universal background check bill, will that 90% of the people go out and vote in the next election against candidates who refuse to support it? Because I think that what elected officials are looking at is not just the polling numbers. They want to look at how many people are actually going to vote on the basis of that issue. And I think many in Congress and the Senate have decided that of the people who are going to vote on this issue, there's far more of them that are pro-gun and opposed to background checks than there are who are pro-gun control and who are going to vote only for candidates who support background checks.
And where do the American people stand on other parts of gun safety measures? What about magazine clips?
Well, it's really interesting. If you ask Americans general questions like, do you support stricter gun control laws? What you'll find is that only about 50% or right around there, a little bit more, a little bit less, depending on the poll, support stricter gun laws. However, if you ask them about specific reforms, like do you think we should have universal background checks, which would be stricter gun laws than we currently have, you get answers about 90-95%, adding people to the terrorist watch list, 90-95%. Even restrictions on high-capacity magazines poll in the 70-80% range. I think a lot of people think that there's really no reason why even someone who has a valid need for self-defense would need to fire 17 rounds in such an incident.
Mm-hmm. Salon had an interesting piece. I don't know if you saw this or not, but it was talking about what's happening with the Colorado Republican Party, who even as the president is speaking today in Colorado is making, let me quote from the article, a high-profile effort to derail Democratic legislation that would disarm domestic abusers. And there is concern, perhaps, among some that women, particularly in the last election, voted overwhelmingly Democratic. When you were talking about whether or not people go to the polls and vote for or against somebody based on gun control, there is some concern that women in places like Colorado, where the Republican Party is looking at this issue, which seems to be a common sense issue, will say, the Republican Party doesn't speak for me anymore.
And, you know, there's a possibility that other of the groups that the GOP, after the November 2012 election, said they needed to appeal to are also big supporters of gun control. So we heard a lot after the elections that the GOP needs to respond to the growing Latino community in the United States, mm-hmm. that growing demographic. Well, if polls show that Latinos support gun control higher than any other ethnic group in America. And so I think the GOP has a chance to try to appeal to these new demographics, the number of women who are voting and voting Democrat, the number of Latinos who are voting and voting Democrat. But I think that's going to be a very difficult change for the GOP to make. I think you're seeing that at least a little bit in that complete reluctance by members of the GOP in Congress to support new gun control.
And why do Latinos support gun control more than any other demographic?
Determining exactly why is a more difficult question, but one thing we might point out is that many Latinos live in the crime-ridden, poverty-inflicted neighborhoods where gun crime is the worst, and many of them feel that guns are not really necessary for personal self-defense. Now, that said, guns are here to stay. Like I said, they're people who always have access to them for self-defense. But I do think that the GOP might be able to make some headway if it starts actually changing some of its policies with regards to major high-profile issues in order to appeal to that Latino community.
We welcome phone calls. We have many of them. One line, however, is open if you'd like to join the conversation. Our guest this hour is Adam Winkler. He's been with us before. He is an expert on guns in America. He is a professor of constitutional law at UCLA, and his book is Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America, which is an extraordinarily fair-minded look at this highly contentious issue. What do you think the president, for those of you who believe in more regulation of guns, needs to do to make a case for that in Colorado? Has the moment passed now? Have we forgotten about Newtown, where it seemed as though there was more public support and really congressional support for some kind of gun measures? Has that moment passed? The role of the NRA in this, the question of the hour, what are sensible gun safety measures? What are they? 800-486-8655 is the number. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second hour of our program this Wednesday, Lori Winters will be joining us. Lori has done so many things. She was the extraordinary director of exhibitions for the Milwaukee Art Museum. She is the founder of a Milwaukee-based international arts think tank, and she is now chief executive officer of the Museum of Wisconsin Art in West Bend. They have a brand new facility. It's opening this weekend, and it's, I haven't seen it, but it's supposed to be gorgeous, and it will house Wisconsin artists' work. So we'll talk with Lori about that. All right, to your phone calls, 800-486-8655. Professor Adam Winkler is our guest, and we start our calls with Ed in Janesville. Hi, Ed.
Good morning. I just wanted to comment. I went to reapply for a driver's license renewal. I'm 51 years old last week, and we already have a universal background federal check called Real ID. I was told I needed a passport, a birth certificate, an original Social Security card just to renew my driver's license. I don't know how many folks are aware of that either, but that's something that I suppose everybody's going to be subjected to in the near future. But I'm really adamantly hoping that the president shows some additional leadership on this issue and really move our society to a more just and humane place and a more common sense approach. I live in Wisconsin. Everybody hunts deer, turkey, et cetera. Got no problem with that, but this is a simple question of right and wrong. Nobody needs a high-powered magazine or an assault rifle in our society. We have adequately trained and professional local police officers who I support, and I just see no basis for this whatsoever. And I'm hoping the president in his second term will step up a little bit more on the leadership end of things and get this done.
Thanks for the call, Ed. Professor Winkler.
Well, it does seem to me that it's hard to criticize the president for not making this an important issue. He has made it really the signature issue of his second term. He's put a lot of his own personal and political capital on the line. He's obviously not giving up on the effort to try to get new gun control laws. He not only emphasized the need for a vote in a State of the Union address, but also we're seeing a push right now where he's going out a week before the Senate's scheduled to start deliberating on gun control proposals and trying to gin up some public support. I think that one of the interesting things we're seeing is perhaps the birth of a new gun control movement in America.
Mm.
You know, over the last 20 years, it's really only been the pro-gun side that's been politically active, and the gun control movement's been very quiet. But we're seeing not only the president invest a lot of time and resources, we're seeing people like Andrew Cuomo, the New York governor, who's a potential presidential candidate in the next election, come out in support of new gun control laws. We're seeing Michael Bloomberg and Gabrielle Giffords start new political action committees and spending campaigns to try to make gun control a bigger issue. That could be the biggest change from the gun debate from Newtown.
How effective do you think the massive amount of money that Bloomberg has put into various Democratic races to influence legislation here and their votes on legislation concerning gun safety, how effective will that be?
I guess we'll just have to see. You know, it's hard to know in advance how effective any spending campaign will be. You know, it depends on whether people are going to follow the advice of those ads and actually vote on the basis of this issue. This is the thing that I tell friends in the gun control community all the time. You know, you can't just tell pollsters you support gun control. You actually got to go and vote for the candidates who support gun control and vote against those who don't if you want to make a difference. The people in the gun rights community understand that and understand it very well and use it very effectively. So we're going to have to see that happen on the other side if there's going to be more balance in the gun debate.
Charlie in Milwaukee, hi.
Hi, Kathleen. I love your show, Fair and Balanced Always. I just wanted to say that as a conservative, I find it funny that both parties can talk out both sides of their mouth. If the conservative movement believes in background checks for voting rights, they should also believe in background checks and restrictions on gun ownership. And if they don't believe in that, it should apply to all rights both ways. We need to be consistent. And I do agree with the previous caller that we don't need unfettered regulation of gun control. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Charlie.
Yes, I think that's a great point. You know, we often hear that we should treat the Second Amendment exactly like we treat the First Amendment, freedom of speech, and that gun ownership should be robust, uninhibited, and unregulated. But, you know, we treat our rights differently depending on their underlying context. Maybe the right to bear arms is a little bit more like the right to vote, where we allow people to be registered in advance. And that the Supreme Court has said things like voter ID laws are acceptable. I think there's no doubt that if President Obama is able to get a background check law passed through Congress or perhaps even a restriction on high-capacity magazines, I have no doubt that the Supreme Court would uphold such laws. I think one of the things that's happened is that in the gun debate, it's the NRA that controls the understanding of the Second Amendment and says that all these laws violate the Second Amendment. I think actually if you look closely at the case law that's rising under the Second Amendment, it seems very unlikely that any of those laws would be struck down. There really aren't a violation of the Second Amendment as the courts have defined that provision.
When did the Supreme Court last take up guns? Was it handguns in Chicago or?
Yes, in 2010, the Supreme Court ruled in a case called McDonald against City of Chicago.
that the Second Amendment applied to state and local governments, not just the federal government, and called into question Chicago's ban on handguns. It looks like the Supreme Court may take another case in the next year or so. There's been a bunch of controversies over concealed carry of firearms and what kind of permitting laws can states impose on concealed carry license holders. There's a good chance that that'll be the next big Supreme Court case on guns.
Thanks, Charlie. Let's go to Mike in Madison. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Three quick points. First one is, having been someone who grew up in Chicago, was with a very high crime rate, I have to say that the ban currently isn't going to do anything to lower any of the homicide rates in any major city. I think there were 360-plus murders in Chicago last year, almost all of them by handgun. So, I mean, it's a great law. It's going to stop the one or two people per year that want to go on some crazy school shooting binge, and that's great. It'll stop the one or two, but the actual real crime is going to do nothing. Secondly, as someone who lived in Chicago and had their house broken into regularly, have been held at gunpoint personally while they stole stuff from my house, I am now a gun owner and am pro-gun ownership. And then thirdly, as far as background checks go, I'm pro-background check. We already have one. And for me personally, for anybody that's anti-background check, I was born on a military base, and I have a very unique Social Security number. And anytime I go through a background check, it takes at least a week for my background check to come through. It's not like a quick 1 hour, 2 hours. It's a multiple day. So anytime I want to purchase a firearm, it takes at least a week for me to get it. And you know what? I'm comfortable with that. If that's what it takes, that's fine. I'm not a criminal. I have no problem with that. And basically, there's plenty of laws on the books already that we just haven't enforced. And if we're really going to actually make some laws, we need to do something that's actually going to make a change and not just a fluff piece like they're currently have out there.
Thanks, Mike. Professor Winkler.
Well, I agree with the caller's sentiment that many gun control measures that we are considering or that we might consider probably not going to have a huge effect on gun crime in America. I think we should think of the problem as really a public health problem. There's about 30,000 people who die every year from gun deaths. We need to lower that number, and it's not going to be lowered from 30,000 to zero or 30,000 to 1,000, but maybe it can be lowered from 30,000 to 29,500 in the next few years, and maybe a few years after that we can get it down to 28,000, and you slowly make some progress on this. I think something like a universal background check, as the caller said, is probably a meaningful kind of reform that will make it that much more difficult for criminals and the mentally ill to find the easy loopholes and get easy access to guns. It's not going to stop all criminals from getting their hands on guns. Of course not, any more than laws requiring people to be 21 to drink doesn't stop every high school student who wants to get their hands on alcohol from doing so. But it provides greater incentives, makes it more difficult for them to do so, and has an effect on the margins.
Let's talk a little bit, because this has become a big point of controversy among the teachers' unions and the NRA, the School Shield program that has been detailed over the last few days, where a staff member in every school in the country should have 40 to 60 hours of training, and the NRA would be in favor of teachers being able to arm themselves as well. There is something jarring about thinking that schools have to arm themselves. That's not what we think of when we think of going to school.
Well, that's right, although, you know, the truth is a lot of schools in America over the last 20 or 30 years have moved towards armed guards, in part because of desires to eliminate drugs and alcohol and criminal activity, especially in more crime-ridden or poor neighborhoods. So these are commonplace, police are commonplace in many schools. I don't think that there's, I know school administrators, I think a lot of the public would support increased guards in places like schools. But we should recognize, I think interestingly enough, you know, the NRA criticizes so many gun control proposals because they're partial measures and won't completely stop the underlying criminal activity that we hope to stop. But the same thing can be said about the NRA's proposal. Last year we had mass shootings at a movie theater, at a shopping mall, at a day spa, and at a coffee shop. And none of those places are going to have armed guards under this proposal. I think it's a telling sign that, you know, look, this is a big problem. It's not going to be solved by any single measure of legislation. And maybe something like more guards in schools plus universal background checks might make a difference.
What about arming teachers?
Well, I think that, you know, if you have teachers that are well-trained, then having teachers with guns is not necessarily an awful thing. I know many people object to them because they feel that that can make the educational environment one in which students are not comfortable participating. And perhaps it might lead to more accidents. But I think the problem is that too many people are not trained. You know, the NRA says we should have 40 to 60 hours of training before we have an employee in the school that has a gun. But, you know, the truth is in most states that allow concealed carry, it's nothing near that kind of training. Sometimes it's only an hour or 2 hours of training.
Woo.
In some states, you don't have to do any training to carry a concealed weapon. And we're expecting those people to defend ourselves. I think actually the NRA's proposal has some certain telling aspects that reveal important truths about the gun debate.
Why would most teachers disagree with you on that, do you think?
I think most teachers probably don't want to be armed. I think most teachers think that the educational environment is not going to be helped by them having a sidearm. You know, the truth of the matter is it's not just most teachers, it's most people. While most people in America support the right of people to have guns for personal protection, very, very few people want to carry guns out onto the street. They're a high-profile group. But even if there's the right to carry concealed weapons, you find that only a very small fraction of the population has any interest in carrying guns on them.
Email that's come in from Brian. Estimated number of gun owners in this country, 50 million from the Washington Post. He cites members of NRA, 4.5 million, their claim. So Brian asks, who represents gun owners, not Wayne LaPierre, who he says is the lackey of the gun manufacturers?
Well, it's one of the consistent problems in the gun debate is that the voice that is heard the loudest is the voice of the NRA. And on so many issues, the leadership of the NRA has been quite separate from and divided from the underlying membership. They take things like background checks. You can find polls will show 80% of NRA members want universal background checks, but yet the NRA is completely and diehard opposed to it. So there's always been this sort of a disconnect between the leadership of the NRA and gun owners. However, the connection that's strong is between the NRA and gun voters. And I think that's where it really matters. The gun control people need more single-issue voters on their side to combat the NRA.
Well, why is the NRA leadership so out of sync with their membership?
Well, I think the NRA leadership is probably out of sync with its membership in part because the members who are the most active, the ones who give the most money, the ones who get most involved in the NRA, are more in line with the NRA's membership. You know, this is not unusual for an interest group on some big political issue to have a more extreme view of the issue than the average member. Average members often have a more sophisticated or nuanced or a more balanced approach to these issues. But part of what interest groups get paid to do is to take extreme views so that they can make their fights, take their fights to Congress and win.
But wouldn't it behoove the NRA to, as they suggested they were in favor of not that many years ago, agree to universal background checks and then fight on every other issue? Wouldn't it make them appear more reasonable?
I would think that that would make them appear more reasonable, and I was personally surprised that the NRA didn't take a more conciliatory tone after Newtown when things really did seem to have changed. But I guess the NRA, you know, the NRA didn't become the political powerhouse that it is by following my advice. They've got their own strategies, and it's proven pretty successful in the past. We'll just have to wait and see, I guess, in the next elections whether they've chosen the right strategy.
We go to Rod next. Hi, Rod.
Hi, Kathleen. How are you?
All right. How are you?
I'm doing good. I'm doing good. Thank you. Hey, Kathleen, I had just had a comment, and I told your screener that to me, I've just got one main point. It comes down to choice. I believe that when it comes to the government doesn't always have my best interests in mind, and that when it comes down to it, I have several friends that have made the same comment that an earlier caller had commented in with and said that there's no need for these high-powered weapons and there's no need for high-capacity magazines. But you can look at that same person and probably pick out one or two things in that guy's house or that guy's ownership that you can look at him and say, why do you need that? That's not necessary. Do you need a fast car? Do you need a house with fancy windows? It comes right down to a choice. Does a person have a choice in this country to have the things that they want, whether they necessarily need them or not, is not the point. It's a choice.
Yeah, but you're talking about a very lethal weapon, and we've had national attention drawn to it because of the massacres we've all had to go through.
I absolutely agree with you when it comes to these weapons can be dangerous if fallen into the wrong hands. Now, I mean, as an ex-military person, I understand that certain weapons can be very, very deadly. Again, I don't disagree with background checks, even if they have to amp that up a little bit and maybe increase the wait time before they issue a weapon like this to somebody.
Mm-hmm.
But what I really think it comes down to, again, is a choice. And these weapons in the hands of the right people are not necessarily a bad thing, just like a vehicle. If you have a very fast car, goes 110 miles an hour, well, guess what? You can kill somebody at 110 miles an hour just as fast as you'd kill somebody with a bullet.
Professor Winkler.
Well, I think there's something to the idea of choice. We should recognize that all our choices are restrained somewhat, and for currently under federal law, it's illegal to buy a brand new machine gun to use for home defense, and no one's going to say you should have a grenade launcher or a shoulder-fired missile as a part of the exercise of your choice. I think the caller is right, though, about the assault weapons ban. These weapons are not often used in criminal activity. They're very misunderstood. Many people think they're machine guns when they're not. And there are millions of them out there, and they're rarely used for criminal activity. So I think it's one of those issues where, when it comes to assault weapons, there should be choice because these guns really aren't functionally different from so many other firearms that people will be enabled to choose, even if you have that law in effect. So we have to balance people's freedoms and ability to make choices with overall concerns about public safety on issues of guns in the same way that we do on so many other issues in America.
Let's talk about the emotional toll, and it's still hard to listen to family members who lost, particularly in that Newtown Sandy Hook shooting. It was just horrible, horrible, horrible. All of these mass shootings have been. But you listen to most of these parents and people in the community. You listen to Gabby Giffords and her husband. You listen to people from Columbine or from the Aurora shooting. And it seems to me as though we have to address them in some way, that you can't just say, well, it's our right, you know, it's a choice that we have, that there's an underlying problem here, that these kinds of tragedies happen in this country because they do linger with us, and they do make us all feel not safe, and there's something terribly wrong about them. How are we addressing that?
I'm not sure that we really are addressing it. It seems that the debate has really shifted away from the families in Newtown and more to issues of whether guns are a good thing or a bad thing. I think if we took all the callers that have called today and we wrote out exactly, transcribed what they asked about and what they said, what we see is a lot of discussion about whether people should be able to have access to guns or not.
Right.
That's not the issue on the table. That's not what's being debated in Washington today. Everyone's still going to be able to get their hands on guns unless they're mentally ill or a felon and wouldn't be able to pass a background check. So, you know, the debate has really shifted. I will say that the most poignant moment in the last 4 months for me personally was when I went to Newtown to do an episode of the Katie Couric Show and met so many of the families and to see their pain on their faces and to see their tears and how they just didn't stop flowing. It's a really powerful reminder that we really should be doing everything we can within the confines of the Second Amendment to keep the guns out of the hands of mentally ill people and criminals. It's not going to save everyone, but we can lower that daily death toll, and that every day that's one more family that's not crying.
It must have been so hard to talk to those families, Professor Winkler.
It's incredibly hard, but you know, it's part of what we have to do. We have to confront those families, and we have to deal with them. And I applaud the families that have taken their pain and said, hey, we're going to go out and be active on this issue, because if we don't be active on this issue now, other families are going to lose their lives. Victims are the most powerful advocates for gun control.
Yeah. Thanks, Rod, for your call. John in La Crosse. Hi, John.
Yes. Good program, Kathleen. Thank you.
Thank you for calling.
And I'm concerned about the limited transparency in how much money the NRA, the ammunition manufacturers, and the gun manufacturers are pouring into this particular issue. You'll notice that the NRA has criticize Mayor Bloomberg and his dollars. But, for example, how much money did the NRA pour into Paul Ryan's campaign or Ron Johnson's campaign or our other senator's campaign recently?
I don't know. Do you know the answer to that?
No, but I'm wondering about it. But they're all three are powerful lobbies. How about some transparency?
I would imagine we have transparency on that, don't we, Professor Winkler, where the NRA's political contributions are going?
Well, we have some transparency, but as a result of that Supreme Court decision a few years ago in Citizens United, we've seen a lot of the campaign finance rules become undermined with regards to the NRA and all major political spenders.
Mm-hmm.
But what we do know is that in the November 2012 elections, the NRA did make a lot of disclosed expenditures, and a Sunlight Foundation report found that they had the worst rate of return of any major political spender on the 2012 election, that very few of their candidates were elected or reelected.
Mm-hmm.
However, I do think part of that story was that the NRA was not really activated and pro-gun voters did not see guns as a major issue in the 2012 election. Seems kind of poor foresight, I guess, in the wake of what's happened since. But at the time, there wasn't really any major gun issues. I think the NRA is likely to be more successful as a political force in the next election because guns really are a central issue again in America.
More phone calls in a moment. We're talking about guns this hour. The president has taken his appeal for gun reform to Colorado today. He will arrive in Denver this afternoon, meet with local law enforcement officials, community leaders, and then will be delivering remarks on common sense measures to reduce gun violence. That's taking place today. We're looking at the variety of issues that surround gun control, and it's interesting to look at what Colorado has done. They have passed significant legislation, as Connecticut has as well. It's interesting the places that have seen these horrific mass shootings, be it in the West or in the East, have taken on this issue in a way that other states haven't. Would you agree that maybe we're seeing the beginning of a movement to counter the NRA in this country that will grow in strength? It's interesting to me the number of people who have called in today who really are strong believers in the Second Amendment and the right to own assault weapons, but everybody has said universal background checks make sense. I'll wait a week to get my guns. Should the NRA agree to that? And why has this issue kind of lost some of its momentum? Will the president move that momentum forward as a result of his visit to Colorado today? 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org. And you can always leave messages on this issue because we like to read them on our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program, the new director of the Museum of Wisconsin Art, and it's also a new museum, which is opening this weekend in West Bend. Lori Winters will be joining us. She's a really interesting person and has done so many wonderful things in the world of art in this city and also in the world. Also, James Shields will be part of the conversation, associate professor at the School of Architecture and Urban Planning at UW-Milwaukee, who designed the new building in West Bend, which opens on Saturday. He also designed Discovery World, I guess. All right, that should be fun. Guns this hour, Eugene and Viola, hello.
Good morning, Kathleen. There's a simple answer to this. Limit ammunition. No ammunition, no guns, no problems. And I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Thanks, Eugene.
Well, it's a very good point, and people recognize that. There's a famous bit that Chris Rock did, the comedian, where he said, you know, we don't need gun control. We just need to put a tax on ammunition where it costs $10,000 a round, and that people won't be shooting their bullets too quickly in that situation. Or even if they do, they'll try to get the bullet back from the person after they've shot it. And, you know, sometimes people think that that's a clever way to get around the Second Amendment. But the Supreme Court said in the Heller case, decided in 2008, that the Second Amendment protects the right of an individual to have a fully functional firearm in their home for self-defense. Without access to ammunition, there is no functional part of the firearm. And so people need to be able to have access to ammunition, and higher excessive taxes on ammunition designed to curb people's use of guns might run afoul of the Constitution in the same way that excessive taxes on ink designed to discourage people from publishing newspapers would probably violate the First Amendment.
Let's go to Randy in Key Wascom. Hi, Randy.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. I guess I have a problem with the anti-Second Amendment zealots that push more laws are the same people that really don't enforce the laws that are there. Chicago, New York, and Los Angeles have some of the highest gun crime rates in the country, yet they have the lowest prosecution of gun crime. Now, we get to Dianne Feinstein, the author of the gun ban bill. In the bottom of that bill, I read it, there is a provision in there that gives the Attorney General the right to ban any firearm for any reason he sees whatsoever. Now, Dianne Feinstein also made a statement at one time that all veterans are mentally unstable and should not be allowed to own firearms.
Oh, she never said anything like that. Come on. She's a smart woman. She wouldn't say all veterans are mentally unstable. I am unfamiliar with this part of the bill that the Attorney General could ban any weapon. Can you enlighten me, Professor Winkler?
Well, like I said, the assault weapons ban is not really going anywhere too quickly. And there are some provisions in Feinstein's bill that would authorize the Attorney General to make certain determinations that other firearms that were designed to escape the assault weapons ban could be listed as assault weapons. But like I said, that ban is not really going anywhere anytime soon. What we really should be focusing on is whether universal background checks, how can we make a good universal background check system, and whether that would be effective.
Mm-hmm. Again, in her instance, she spoke pretty movingly, and this has to impact your life in a substantial way when the mayor of San Francisco was gunned down and she walked in and saw the body and the blood, and it's understandable that she would take up this issue and she would have a personal connection to this issue.
Absolutely, and we find that the gun control community now is heavily populated by people who've been victims of gun violence. You know, for a lot of people in America, the gun violence problem seems very abstract because they live in communities where there's a lot of guns and there's very little gun violence. And the violence that they see, they don't associate with guns so much as they associate with troubled individuals, mental illness, or just evil intent and criminality. So for many people, it's very abstract. But if you're someone who's been victimized, then you're often likely to support gun control. That's in part, by the way, why we see incredibly high support for gun control among African-American communities, among Latino communities.
Yes.
Because these are the communities that are witnessing and feeling
the gun violence. Yeah, exactly. Maybe I was too harsh on the caller, but you have to be careful what you say about somebody. And are you aware of Senator Feinstein saying that all veterans are mentally unstable?
No, I haven't seen that quote, so I can't really speak to it. What we do know is that there's been a real focus these days on mental illness.
Right.
And in some ways, that can be a distraction. While it's true we want to have better mental illness records in the federal background check system that we have, and if we're going to improve that system, we need to have even better reporting of information. Apparently, only about 4 states report comprehensive mental health adjudications to the federal background check system. So these people are not in the background check system at all. But we also want to be careful not to demonize all forms of mental illness. A lot of people go have mental struggles over the course of their lives. Doesn't mean they're necessarily unsafe to have a firearm. We just want to get guns out of the hands of the dangerously mentally ill.
Only 4 states? Is that right?
That's right. We have a
law.
The Supreme Court once said in 1997 that the federal government cannot require states to provide that information to the background check system. It was a violation of state sovereignty and states' rights. What the federal government can do is provide financial incentives to encourage states to perform. And we did provide some federal incentives and money in the wake of the shooting at Virginia Tech, that horrible school shooting.
Yes.
But still to this day, very few states are fully in compliance with that law.
All right, let's go to the Second Amendment. Jim writes, do gun rights advocates ignore the first part of the amendment, the part that links gun possessions to militia?
Well, not exactly. They're often accused of doing that, but I don't think that's the case. The Supreme Court said in the 2008 Heller case that when the framers inserted the line about a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, they were referring to common persons, ordinary people owning guns, that they found quotes from the framers saying, what is the militia? The militia are the common people called out to serve. We got to remember, at the founding era, the framers were afraid of a standing army. They thought it would be used corruptly by the president in the same way that standing armies had been used corruptly by English kings. So they thought that the national defense would be best served by a citizen's militia, ordinary people who, when called out to serve, would run home, grab their guns, and be ready to fight in an instant, hence the Minutemen of revolutionary fame. So they thought that the well-regulated militia was the body of citizens who were capable of defending the nation. The Supreme Court said that basically means today virtually everybody.
And we do have now, Rhonda found this for me. Thank you, Rhonda. I would have been sitting here wondering. Senator Dianne Feinstein rejected an amendment to her assault weapons ban that would exempt veterans. She explained the problem with expanding this is that, you know, with the advent of post-traumatic stress disorder, which I think is a new phenomena as a product of the Iraq War, it's not clear how the seller or transfer of a firearm covered by this bill would verify that an individual was a member or a veteran and that there is no impairment of that individual with respect to having a weapon like this. I think you have to, if you're going to do this, find a way that veterans who are incapacitated for one reason or another mentally don't have access to this kind of weapon. So there
it is. And that seems to be saying that, hey, we shouldn't have put more loopholes into the background check law. There are some veterans who, through post-traumatic stress disorder or just ordinary mental illness, probably shouldn't be entrusted to have firearms in our civilian community, maybe even abroad as well. But it doesn't sound like she's saying that all veterans suffer from mental illness, but just that veterans as a group are not categorically excluded from having mental illness. And indeed, part of the problem with the background check system that we have is we have too many loopholes that allow people to get access to guns without having to do one of these background checks.
Yeah, thanks for getting that information to us quickly, Rhonda. Bob in Ashland. Hi, Bob.
Good morning. A lot of discussion that I've heard has been around freedom and the fear of confiscation of their guns. Even a relative that's in the military is talking about he wouldn't be willing to confiscate guns under order. But I don't think they understand how government operates. The government doesn't operate by confiscating cigarettes because they discourage the use. They just tax it. And the same way with cars in D.C. There's too many cars in D.C., so registration's like $10,000 to register a car. So I think taxing would still give you the freedom to own, but provide money to do background checks and enforce current laws.
Well, we could definitely have some taxes on firearms transfers, for instance, in the same way that we have taxes on sales of other kinds of items. We could not, however, adopt excessive taxation specifically designed to keep people from having guns for self-defense. I think that would violate the Second Amendment and the right of the people to keep and bear arms. Like I said, the Supreme Court has held that you have a right to a functional firearm in your home. Any law that's designed to make owning a firearm prohibitively expensive would likely run afoul of that constitutional provision. But I like the idea of thinking outside of the box. It's not just about banning a particular firearm. We need to try to come up with better solutions through a variety of different mechanisms, whether it's guards in schools or whether it's different kinds of outreach programs in communities where gun violence is the most profound, whether it's universal background checks. It's going to take thinking outside the box to lower that daily death toll from guns.
What's the story with the Senate? They're taking this up early next week or when?
It looks like things are going to be pushed back, I think, until the second week, until around April 15th. That was the report I read this morning. I don't have confirmation on that, but that's what it looked like. I think basically Senator Reid is trying to create a little bit more space to try to find some compromise. I think that there's a sense still among Democrats that despite all the bad news in the media, that they might still be able to get this law passed if they can get something good to the floor of Congress, and that they just need to peel off a few Republicans. I think actually it may be more difficult than that. We've already had some Republicans promise they're going to filibuster any gun law, which I think is a really telling sign. They're going to filibuster any gun law. It doesn't matter whether it's a good gun law, whether it's going to keep guns out of the hands of criminals. And I think that's part of the success of the NRA is to define any gun control law as a bad thing that's a violation of the Second Amendment. When it's probably
it
not
is
true.
Hard to believe that that's not going to hurt some of those people politically because of what the country has been through. Maybe that's wild thinking on my part, but it's hard to believe that they're not going to suffer consequences considering where we are now after the shootings.
Well, you know, it really depends. I generally take it that the elected officials who need to, whose career depends on them securing enough votes to be reelected, I generally figure they've got the most incentive to get a good lay of the land of what's going to hurt them and what's going to help them electorally.
Yeah.
Someone like Ted Cruz, I think, figures that in Texas it's not going to hurt
right.
him very bad. And he just won election. He's got 6 years before he comes up again.
Yeah.
But Marco Rubio has also joined the calls for a filibuster, and he's a potential presidential nominee
yeah.
in the next election.
It'll be interesting to see how it plays out. We're out of time. You're great. Thanks, Professor Winkler, for being with us.
Anytime.
Professor Adam Winkler, our guest this hour. We wanted to talk about guns because the president is in Colorado talking about guns. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Katie Mattson for on-air production in lovely downtown Milwaukee where the sun is shining. We have another hour coming up.